Weather Service for this Tuesday, March 27th. Cloudy and mild, 50-50 chance of more light rain for the morning hours. Today's high, 53. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 33. Wednesday, sunny and 56. Right now, overcast, 48 degrees are seen, 50 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Support for WGTD in the morning show also comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology. Online degrees for emerging careers from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. You can learn more by visiting uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm so pleased to be able to welcome back to the program Dr. Yuri Maltsev, professor of economics at Carthage College, part of the acclaimed Clausen Center at Carthage College. And Professor Maltsev has been a frequent guest on the morning show, and this visit is overdue. I'm actually really glad we waited until now because it could not be more timely. The nation of Russia, from where Yuri Maltsev originates, has been in the news several times over. I mean, the headlines are really dominated by Russia and Vladimir Putin for various reasons. So it is great timing indeed to have Professor Maltsev here to offer his perspective on some of what has been going on. There's all kinds of things for us to talk about. And Professor Maltsev, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Oh, thank you, Greg. Always a pleasure.
Good to have you here. And ahead of us digging into Vladimir Putin, among other topics, I thought since it's been a little while since you've been on the program, I thought it would be very interesting for you to just summarize a little bit about your own background so people understand the rich experience and the particular perspective from which you are drawing as you talk about Russia. It is where you were originally, where you worked, and which you left ultimately in 1989. Just tell us a little bit about what you did and what life was like for you in Russia.
Well, thank you, Greg. This so-called rich experiences maybe were sometimes bizarre experiences.
Yeah.
And I was born and raised in Kazan, which is capital of Tatarstan, which is a Muslim part of Russia. And it's in the middle of Russia. It was founded by Tatars and Mongols during Genghis Khan invasion. And then when I was 15, my family moved to Moscow. And so I went to Moscow State University. And graduated from there, then got my PhD in labor economics. And in 1985, when Mr. Gorbachev was elected General Secretary of the Communist Party of Soviet Union, well, elected by 11 people, Politburo members, and I was invited to be part of his team working on his economic reforms of perestroika. And and I was very excited, and I joined this team. But then I realized that the whole idea was cosmetics, not the real changes, not the real change. I worked with the Prime Minister of Soviet Union, Mr. Ryzhkov, and he used to say, comrades, we should change everything, but without touching anything.
And that's sort of what they were attempting to do?
Exactly. Or Mr. Gorbachev sometimes would say, comrades, I heard there's a lot of critics of central planning. Central planning is good. The problem is that we never had a good plan. Mm. And then you really think, and I remember where the top Soviet politician was sitting next to me when we heard this, and he said, do you think there is something behind this birthmark? And I said, I think maybe some shallow space. He said, I think the same.
Wow. Now, what's interesting, just that we can't talk about this forever, but it's too interesting not to at least touch on it. So what you're suggesting is that this, or what I think you're kind of suggesting is that what we think of as sweeping dramatic changes in what was the Soviet Union, in some respects, were not sweeping enough. Or is it that certain things did, in fact, dramatically change, but not certain economic realities? They were not maybe reformed the same way other aspects of life there were reformed.
Exactly. The reforms were ill-devised and half-implemented, and so that was one of the problems. But I think I shared with you an article about Alexander Yakovlev, who was person number two in the Gorbachev administration. And perestroika in Russian means restructuring. And what Yakovlev, he was an inspiring person for all of us, because his idea was to restructure the evil empire of Soviet Union into the rubble. Mm. So he had different agenda than Mr. Gorbachev. Maybe Mr. Gorbachev had whatever agenda is, but we never knew. He all the time would talk about superiority of socialist choice, so-called, and definitely it didn't work. And so, but what he did, Mr. Gorbachev, he removed fear out of the system, which was glued together only by fear. And that's why the system collapsed like that. When they stopped killing people, when they stopped sending people to Siberia, Gorbachev was all the time talking about socialism with a human face, with a human face. And maybe if we have just a minute, I can tell you a pretty funny joke from that time in Russia, that in CIA, in the president of the United States, didn't know what's happening there, what is Gorbachev about, and what is perestroika. And they found out that James Bond, just retired, and available for consulting job. So they send James to Moscow, and James is walking in Moscow with a little notebook. He goes to a bakery and writes in his notebook, no bread. He goes to a butcher shop, no meat. He goes to a shoe store, no shoes. And there is a KGB officer looking over his shoulder. He said, a year ago, you would be shot for doing that. He writes there, no bullets. and so when people... when people realized no bullets, then everybody stopped working. It was just almost overnight. And the whole thing began to implode. So
wow.
That's
so it was a, as you said, a system based on fear, based on intimidation. Mm-hmm. And when that fear and intimidation was removed from the equation, and not enough of the rest of it was changed.
Yes.
It in a sense, collapsed.
Absolutely. Because the socialist economy can only work if you threat people with death or with something really bad like Siberian exile or whatever. Why this is the case? Many people in the United States don't understand that. Why socialists must kill? Because there is absolutely no incentives, no economic incentive to that economic system. And that's not even an economic system. It's a simple system of management. You do what I say or else. So this is, there's no, and if you are paid the same, whether you work or not, then most people don't. So this is the case. And then unless you threaten them. So because of that, in the Soviet Union alone, anywhere from 40 to 60 million people were murdered during Lenin's and Stalin's watch. So this was, and this enormous sufferings of Russian people, of people in China, people in North Korea, in Yugoslavia, everywhere in the socialist world, people would be killed just to make them work.
Does this help us explain the rise of somebody like Vladimir Putin? That is he, and his style of leadership, does that in a sense fill a void that was left by some of this, in a sense, mismanagement back in the late 1980s?
Very good question. I think that very good question, because the key to understanding Mr. Putin and Putinism as some kind of ideology of so-called managed democracy, that's his slogans, the key to understanding it would be 1980s and 1990s, that he was an antithesis to Mr. Yeltsin. Boris Yeltsin, he was a true anti-communist, I would say. He was, he had some weird sense of humor. But unfortunately, personally, he was, I had a very dubious pleasure of working with him. And he was, here we would call him, that he was all the time GUI, governing under influence. He was, I hate to say that, he was drunk almost all the time.
Really?
Yeah, he was, I think, imitating Winston Churchill, or even sometimes referring to Winston Churchill. But he became, he was captured already by 1994-1995 by the KGB crowd. And so then he was just a puppet of these people. They unleashed this war on Chechnya, first war on Chechnya. And then Mr. Putin, who was born into a family of Stalinists, his grandfather was a Stalin's cook. So that was very important, as it was more important than Minister of Food, definitely. And his father was in the KGB, a technical specialist. And Mr. Putin, already in the ninth grade, he applied to work in the KGB. And KGB asked him to get an education first, and he did. And then he became a deputy to mayor of St. Petersburg, at that time Leningrad. Mr. Sobchak, Anatoly Sobchak, whom I knew personally, he was the one who renamed Leningrad back into St. Petersburg. He was an anti-communist. He was pretty good reformer. And his daughter, that's a very small world, his daughter, Ksenia Sobchak, she was running against Mr. Putin on this last elections last week. And so, and Ksenia Sobchak, she is, I wanted to say beautiful, but she, in United States Academy, you shouldn't say that. She's, I would say, optically superior. And optically superior. And she was a model. She is right now is a TV anchor and a journalist and a very gifted lady. But unfortunately, she was, when she was younger, she was not responsible enough. And so Mr. Putin and his cronies, they flooded the whole internet with her naked pictures. So they kind of, their political life is very similar to what we have in the United States, when you don't even know what's the difference between the so-called serious newspaper and tabloid. So that's she's number three or number four in different regions of Russia. So speaking about elections. So Mr. Putin, he was a Soviet spy in GDR. He was a liaison officer with the Stasi, infamous East German police. And in 1999, he was appointed by Mr. Yeltsin as an acting prime minister first. Then there were quite mysterious bombings of apartment complexes in Moscow, of which Mr. Putin accused Chechens. And that was a pretext for the Second Chechen War. However, Mr. Litvinenko, Alexander Litvinenko, another victim of Mr. Putin in London, who was poisoned by this very exotic poison polonium-21 in 2006, he wrote a book, Blowing Up Mother Russia.
Mm.
And he squarely accuses Mr. Putin of organizing these terrorist acts by the KGB. Now it's called FSB, but there's no difference. And to create this pretext for militarization of the country and whatnot. And then Mr. Yeltsin, it really like a detective thriller. And then Mr. Yeltsin, on the last day, the last minute of the last millennium, he already introduced Mr. Putin on national TV. That was 31st of December of 1999 as a future president of his choice of the future president. And Putin was elected in March already of 2000 by about 67% of the popular vote, which was quite a problem for many Russians, for the other 33%, as well as ethnic Russians like myself and Russian community in the United States and elsewhere, because KGB, which murdered anywhere again from 40 to 60 million people, and I don't care how many, 40 or 60, both numbers are above my comprehension.
Right, there's both staggering numbers.
Yeah. And Stalin understood that. He would say, death of one is a tragedy. Death of a million, just statistic. Mm. And that was, that's the most cynical kind of approach. Not million tragedies, just statistic.
Right.
And and what Mr. Putin, he is a proud member of the KGB. He never repented. He never said it is kind of bad. He said it's part of our history.
Mm.
However, it didn't prevent him from inaugurating quite recently a monument in Moscow, very touching monument, very well done, monument to the victims of Stalin's repressions.
Mm.
So he is kind of multidimensional. From United States, he is presented as some kind of a dumb dictator and very unpleasant person, whatnot. He has, I'm not a fan of Mr. Putin. When he was elected in year 2000, my last article, which was published in Russian website, had a self-descriptive title, Meat Voted for a Meat Grinder. Because can you imagine if SS or Gestapo officer in Germany would be elected even a dog catcher in a remote village? That would be a national tragedy, soul searching, everything. And that was pretty sad for me to see that Russians forgot all the lessons of history. They usually say the only lesson of history is that it does not teach us anything. and that's exactly what happened. And then Mr. Putin, he was, for 8 years, he was president on his own right. Then constitution only has two terms. So he appointed his spokesman, Mr. Medvedev, as an interim president. Then they changed constitution. Yeltsin, at that time, he was already dying, but he made his famous quip that when he was president, it was easier to change constitution than to buy a gallon of milk in Moscow. But now he said it's easy to do both. And we should credit Mr. Putin for milk, at least.
Wow.
And so Mr. Putin, he was elected already on his last six-year term. Now they change it from 4 years to 6 years. So he will be president of Russia until, 2022.
So this was, he was just elected to his fourth term, his second consecutive term. So explained that that little period where he was not president, where he's had to step away in a sense, but not for very long.
Exactly. And he would need to change constitution again to be elected in 2022.
Right. We're talking with Dr. Yuri Maltsev, professor of economics at Carthage College. You wrote an interesting article just ahead of the most recent election, and you said a couple of different things that were quite striking. One of them is you talked about how apparently one of the basic strategies of Mr. Putin was, in a sense, to allow as many candidates as possible to run against him, which, you know, at a glance might not seem to make a lot of sense, and in fact it makes glorious sense. I mean, it really is sort of an ideal strategy, I suppose, especially in a place like Russia with an especially kind of unbridled political system. Explain what was behind that strategy and explain how well it worked.
Yeah, it worked pretty well for him because he got, 76.67% of the popular vote. And what did he do? He distanced himself from the other crowd, which looked like a circus and behaved like a circus.
His opponents, you mean?
His opponents, yeah. Yes. There were seven of them, and they had debates, for example, and then Ksenia Sobchak, this very bright young lady, she began this so-called debates that she poured a glass of water and splashed this water on Mr. Zhirinovsky, who is a candidate of Liberal Democratic Party, which is no liberal, no democratic, and it's more like a fascist party. That created quite a nice kind of a nice background for Mr. Putin. Because Mr. Putin was not part of this. His point was that I don't need to debate anything. You can see my results. You can see my results, and the results would say everything for themselves. Then Mr. Zhirinovsky, for example, he's a leader of opposition, he's a fascist. He wants to restore Russia in the borders of 1850. Hmm. 1850, that was the height of Russian Empire. That means give him Alaska back.
Ooh.
Give him Finland, Poland. So this would be the kind of that. And Mr. Putin, he endorses Mr. Zhirinovsky, I mean, behind the scenes. For what reason? Because on this kind of background, Mr. Putin looks pretty sober.
Right. It makes Putin look like a reasonable man by contrast.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow. And so there were two communist parties represented. They have two communist parties fighting each other more than capitalism. And then and so the results were he got 77%, then communists got about 10%. Mrs. Sobchak, she got about from anywhere from 1.5% to 4%. And my good friend Grigory Yevlinsky, whom I worked with in the Department of Labor, he got 1%.
So there's this splintering of the opposition. I mean, mm-hmm. even all of the opposition collectively would not have been enough to probably unseat Mr. Putin, but splintered, it was even more far-fetched. For
exactly. And the smartest thing was that he made them fight each other rather than him.
Mm. Right.
So he was not mentioned in these debates. They were fighting each other like whatever. Then what was interesting for me, because I came from this Muslim part of the Soviet Union, that Mr. Putin is making some kind of encroaches into a Muslim community. He got way more Muslim votes in Russia than any other votes.
Hmm.
His popularity among Muslim Russians, about 85%.
Wow.
85%. And the reason, I think, is that we also don't understand that. And even we have some fake news on the social networks that he is anti-Muslim, that he is even some kind of his fake speech, whatever. No, he cannot lose support in the East while having this awful rogue relations with the West. Mm. So this is this.
So he needs to preserve that as much as he can.
So Russia joined World Islamic Conference. Mufti of Russia, the leader of Russian Muslims, is all the time sitting on his right hand. And
I believe you wrote in the article that Mr. Putin's message, the core of his message, was really three prongs: patriotic leadership, managed democracy, strong Russia. I think the one and three make a whole lot of sense at a glance. What about that middle one, the notion of managed democracy? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes.
And what does he mean by that, or what do you mean by that?
He believes that democracy is the best way. I mean, at least that's what he says. It was the best way, but it should be managed because many people abuse democracy from his point of view, many Russians unfortunately agree with that, because in 1990s the bureaucrats and people like Putin, they presented this incessant corruption scandals, this sleaze in society, this everything was just crime was rampant, oligarchs were robbing the country. He presented it as a democracy. He said, that's what you learn, democracy. This is what democracy looks like.
Right, if you leave it unchecked or unmanaged.
Unmanaged, yes. The same thing, his message is with the economy, that the economy should be managed, that economy should be capitalist economy, but it should be managed in a way that to protect the vulnerable, the poor, and whatnot. He created quite a social safety net.
Hmm. I know also that one of the platforms, in a sense, that on which he runs, or one of the things he likes to say quite a lot, is that he views the demise of the Soviet Union back in 90 or 91, whenever that was, mm-hmm. as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And that probably speaks very strongly to the Russian people, I should think.
Exactly, and he also toasted to Stalin several times on receptions in Kremlin. Then, and he is a KGB officer. He recently was asked for the interview. He was asked whether, ex-KGB officer, he immediately interrupted the interviewer. He said, there's no such thing, ex-KGB officer. It's either alive or dead KGB officer.
Mm.
So he still is a proud so-called Chekist. Chekist would be the KGB from Cheka. Lenin started this meat grinder for Russian people.
So that's what he was. That's what he remains, at least
yes, in part of it.
By the way, when a campaign such as it is underway in a place like Russia, are there, for instance, television commercials? I mean, do people see political ads on Russian TV?
Yes, of course. Yes, if you go to Russia, you would see that he controls most of the major TV stations, but he does not control printed press.
Ah.
So there's a lot of, and it's very easy to start it. Then also a lot of blogs. He's trying to control internet, but it's very difficult to do. To block they would block the website, and another website would pop up immediately. And So because of that, there is some, I would say, illusion of plurality, illusion of different voices, of diversity of opinions. I am watching, because I'm doing a lot of seminars and consulting on these Russian issues. My occupational hazard is to watch Russian television, and I'm watching it. And it's pretty entertaining, and sometimes Mr. Putin even, pretty entertaining, because his campaign, he was not debating anything, but he was answering questions. So you could call Mr. Putin and ask him whatever question you have. And in the middle of this call-in thing, after maybe 3 hours already of answering questions, he asked technical assistants how many people are on hold. And she said, about 1,200. He said, 1,200. He said, 1,200. He said, please stay on the line. The next available Putin will be with you shortly.
Wow. We're speaking with Dr. Yuri Maltsev, professor of economics at Carthage College. So Vladimir Putin indeed was reelected president of Russia, but now finds himself in something of a diplomatic crisis, caused in large measure, of course, by this incident in Great Britain involving the poisoning of a former Russian operative and his daughter, and a police officer who came to assist, all still, I think, in critical condition from this chemical attack, which has been blamed on the Russian government, which they officially deny having any part of, but it has ultimately prompted what I think has been characterized widely as pretty much an unprecedented move of something like 23, 24 different nations expelling a number of Russian diplomats because of this incident, including the United States joining in that action. First of all, from what you know, how likely is it, in fact, that the Russian government does bear responsibility for this attack? I mean, is there any possibility that they are not to blame?
Well, it's really really difficult to say. I mean, this agent, the chemical agent, was called Novichok, newcomer. That's this special gas, which is the most deadly, I think. It's definitely not a private venture. And then Mr. Litvinenko, Alexander Litvinenko, who was poisoned in 2006 by this polonium-21, it is also, it's not privately owned. It's a very powerful isotope, and which actually the dose of this to kill a person cost over $100,000. So I think there was not private money involved into that.
Right.
And I met Mr. Litvinenko. There's an interesting place. It's a defectors club in Washington, D.C. called Jamestown Foundation. So I met him there in 2002. He had a wig and goggles. So he was Mr. Putin. Yeah. And there were a lot of other deaths that we don't even know about. There was a Russian oligarch, Boris Berezovsky. He hanged himself in 2010 on an ascot tie in the bathroom. And the Metropolitan Police of London, they've tried to replicate it, and they came to the conclusion that nobody can hang themselves on ascot tie. So if you want to hang yourself, you should have some other tie. Ascot tie doesn't work. And so there's plenty of these mysterious things. And I would say that Russian community is very uneasy here, or in otherwise immigrant community, because you never know. Life expectancy of people who don't like him drops like a rock.
Yeah.
And Mr. Skripal, Sergei Skripal, the one who was poisoned just recently, he did a lot of damage for Mr. Putin, because he was kind of like a human resources guy in the KGB, in an external division. And he sold 350 Russian agents worldwide to the British MI6. And so that they were very much upset with that, so that he was sentenced to 13 years of prison in Russia, and then exchanged in 2010 on the spies which were discovered and arrested here in Washington, D.C. If you remember, it was in 2010 when it happened 3 days after Mr. Medvedev, at that time president of Russia, came to United States. And at that time, Obama administration decided to postpone this arrest, not to spoil the visit. But then they were arrested. They were sent back to Russia. It turned out, however, because now it's very popular TV series called The Americans. And I would say it's kind of, I don't like it, because it never happened like that. Most of these Russian spies, they would defect at some time. I met more KGB officers in Washington, D.C. than in Moscow. And the reason is that they could defect, because they're already here. So these are the kind of the issues that then Russians exchanged for Russians who spied for the United States and United Kingdom on 10 Russians who spied for. So it was Russians to Russians exchange. And my friends in Russia were even worried that Mr. Putin maybe will be building up an exchange kind of pool to exchange for future. However, this Russian spies in Washington, D.C., it looks like I read an assessment of what kind of damage. It looks like almost everything they did could be just Googled. Could be just Googled. Instead of that, they sent me. For what reason? I think Mr. Putin is a control freak. He wants to have his people everywhere. Except maybe one. There was General Vasilenko, who actually presented himself as a Chilean. Interesting that the Russian spies were all Canadians. Why Canadians? Because it was a Canadian. There was a Canadian spy working for KGB, and he worked in archives of the pediatric hospital in Toronto. And so they pulled the birth certificates of little Canadian kids who died a long time ago.
Mm.
And then if you have an original birth certificate, you can go and get Canadian passport anywhere you like.
Hmm.
So that was pretty kind of...
So a little loophole in the system that they've learned to exploit.
That's right, exactly.
Fascinating.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. One of the things that was part of the newscast I heard yesterday about this move for the expulsion of diplomats, that apparently Russians were a bit shocked at the action because, of course, this tragedy had just occurred in Siberia with this shopping mall in which over 60 people, including many children, tragically killed. And there was an assumption made by some anyway that perhaps in the wake of that, this move to expel Russian diplomats might possibly be postponed. But of course, that didn't happen. I mean, there was still a sense that this was a gesture that simply had to be made. What kind of damage do you think this does to Mr. Putin and his government? Or does it not do much in the way of tangible damage to them? Is this more of just kind of a public relations nightmare that about which he does not need to be particularly concerned?
Yeah, I would think that for him it's a positive thing, not negative.
Hmm.
For him, he's all the time presenting himself as a savior of Russia, as a keeper of peace. And he all the time is referring to the West, that the West is against us. So this is a very good example that they're against us, and especially these numbers, stunning numbers, that never in the history of the United States so many Russian diplomats or Soviet diplomats were expelled. I think Mr. Reagan did that with 55 people, and so now it's 60. So this is one thing. Then, so he wouldn't suffer any PR. Besides that, he's already elected, even if But many Russians are definitely very much disappointed because they hoped that in the beginning of time, they hoped that Mr. Trump's election would lead to better relations with Russia. It turned upside down completely. And so right now, the Russians became kind of a pariah in even the United States. That's the first time I feel discrimination myself. Yeah, that's especially on social networks. And that's, people are sending me emails, go to you, and using all kind of words, Russia or your Putin's troll or whatever else, just because of my last name, and they don't read what I'm posting.
Wow. So in other words, you are feeling this, yourself on a very sort of personal level.
Exactly, yes. Wow. And I was invited for some functions, say, in the White House and somewhere else, which were canceled. Because of my last name.
Hmm.
At least, well, they didn't say that openly, but...
Right, but it is your sense that...
Yes.
And, of course, this is interesting because many people, of course, have been struck by what President Trump has had to say about President Putin, and, of course, the fact that against the advice of his advisors, he actually reached out to President Putin, evidently, and congratulated him on his election. President Trump has had very little in the way of criticism. He has not outwardly been critical of Mr. Putin at all. And are you sensing that might also be changing somehow?
There's nothing wrong in congratulating with elections. I mean, Mr. Obama did that to Mr. Putin and to Mr. Medvedev before, and Mr. Clinton he even went to actually canvass for Mr. Yeltsin. He was in before elections in Russia in 1996. And they in Russia, they call it Bill and Boris show. Yeah, they had this. yes, I think that Mr. Trump, he very unfortunately, he made his comments before elections. If you remember, he had some deficit. I think he likes to be liked. And so he made some compliments for Mr. Putin. And that, I think, prompted to some extent or explained to some extent all these ongoing investigations of this Russian. They couldn't find anything, but Mr. Putin Mr. Putin, at first, he was pretty complimentary to Mr. Trump. Now they change. Now he kind of is saying that Trump is less predictable. We would prefer Hillary Clinton. We would know what she is about and what she what's on her mind is. With Mr. Trump, we never know what's on his mind and whatnot. And all my so-called analysts, they are very much disappointed. Mm. I don't see any, if there will be any evidence of Russian meddling, because Russian meddling is usually, it turned out, as stupid as Russian policy makers would make almost everything. Because look what they did. They were supporting Black Lives Matter. They were supporting Bernie Sanders. They provided a lot of ads for Jill Stein. They had, at the same time, they had meetings for Trump and against Trump in New York and Washington, in two different parts of town. So this is bizarre. This is
right. In other words, the Russians, it is simplistic to say that the Russians did whatever they could to help Donald Trump be elected president. They were actually working on all points of the spectrum. If they had any focused purpose, perhaps it was just to try to create more unrest here, maybe heighten the divisions here.
Exactly.
But they clearly were not placing all of their focus on getting a certain person elected president of the United States.
Probably. I'm not sure about that, because Mr. Putin is really enigma wrapped in mystery. But but the thing is that definitely what we saw at the intelligence, you remember in the a year ago in January, just before Mr. Trump was inaugurated, then 16 so-called intelligence agencies they came up with some report. This report was a travesty. I couldn't believe it. It kind of made me think that to have 16 intelligence agencies very unintelligent. Because the report was 8 pages saying that Russian television was promoting Mr. Trump. I am Russian. I do not watch this Russian television in English language, and I don't know if who would watch it, and who would change their mind if they would watch whatever they do. But even if they do, there is nothing wrong with that. There is absolutely no violation of any rules. Or you can watch BBC, you can watch French television, you can watch any other television, can make up your mind, reading whatever your heart desires. This is First Amendment of our Constitution.
Right. So well, and it's none of our business, in a sense, what's on Russian. Russian television belongs to Russia, and they can say whatever they want.
Exactly.
Of course, the activity has gone beyond that, as it appears, in terms of things they have managed to get posted on Facebook and so on, that they have been active here. Does that bother you on both kind of an intellectual level and a personal level, or do you feel like too much is being made of this?
I would say that you can also post anything you like on a social media. The problem is the only violation of the law is that they bought some ads on the Facebook, on the fake accounts. If I'm Ivan Ivanov living in Moscow and I want to pay for an ad, for example, promoting Mr. Trump or promoting Jill Stein or whatever, there is nothing wrong with that even. The wrong thing, if I am not Ivan Ivanov, but I am Sidor Sidorov and a KGB officer, presenting myself as Ivan Ivanov, that is a violation of the law. They have a troll factory, they call it, in St. Petersburg. They have about 400 people working, trolling. I was unfriending so many people because I knew they're trolls. Because they definitely would focus on Russian emigres quite a lot, on this community. But it was very easy to identify them.
Right. And of course, I hope all our listeners understand what a troll is and what trolling is on the internet. And this is where somebody kind of goes out of their way when something gets posted to attack it.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, it's not even something that they personally disagree with, but
right.
It's like they are, in a sense, being employed.
Yeah, paid.
Right. And often some of the most outrageous and hateful things that are posted on the internet will be posted by a troll. It isn't mm-hmm. some person sitting in their living room authentically saying, believing this terrible thing about Yuri Maltsev or Greg Berg or whoever. But as a troll, it is their job to write these inflammatory responses mostly. And it sure seems like Russia seems to have this down to a science. Although maybe there are other places around the world where this occurs too. Or, I mean, do they seem to be exceptionally adept at it, at this business of trolling?
I, to tell the truth, I think they're very, very bad on this as well. Yeah, right. Because you can see the trolls, you can see the message they want to peddle to you right away, and it's a very clumsy message.
So, in other words, they're actually not as sophisticated at actually doing it. I mean, a really good troll, you wouldn't know they were a troll. In other
exactly.
words,
exactly. That's right. There's a funny thing, if anyone is interested. On YouTube, there is a Russian cartoon. And the cartoon has, the title of cartoon is Trolley. Trolley. Hmm. And this cartoon about this trolley farms, the troll farm in St. Petersburg. And pretty funny. Very
really? So what do we type in to find? Or I suppose is it in Russian, however?
Yeah, I think you don't even need to know any language because what it's called trolleybus. Trolleybus. If you will put trolleybus, yeah.
Huh.
In Russia, trolleybus is a trolley.
Isn't it interesting to think about the things that we are talking about now that did not even exist 10, 15 years ago, and now they are a part of our everyday lives in a sense, and really making a difference, usually for ill.
Yes, but I also feel blessed that I not only survived the demise of the biggest evil empire in the world, but now I think it's a very exciting time in the United States. We have so many social changes, so many economic changes, fantastic new technologies, whatnot, and complete disarray, I think, in our kind of social home, in the sense that people so much intolerance, so much hatred, that doesn't make me happy at all.
Yeah. So, yeah, these certainly are interesting times in which we live, and these are interesting times for Russia as well. We just have a minute or so left. What is the state of affairs in Russia right now and for the typical person living in Russia? I mean, what is life like for the typical Russian right now?
Yes, I mentioned that Mr. Putin is not my favorite, definitely, and I do not travel to Russia because, again, life expectancy of people who don't like him drops like a rock. But from another hand, I can attest that Russians do live better, much better than under Soviet Union, definitely. So what Mr. Putin did, he created some kind of like a fascist economy. But even that is much more efficient than what they had central planning thing. Then, for example, last year alone, 12 million Russians went overseas for holidays. Hmm. Never heard of that before. I have friends in Russia who would fly to Paris to listen to an opera or classical music concert. And that would be middle class. They're not oligarchs.
Hmm.
They'll be middle class. They travel. They go. They have cars. They have all kind of appliances. From another hand, having said that, Russian economy is 1/13 of our economy. So we should put everything in perspective.
Mm.
So China is economic powerhouse. Russia is not. It's 1/13. So whatever how arrogant are they do not have resources enough to do that. But the population is, for example, this small fire in Kemerovo. This is ridiculous because in the United States or anywhere in the West, we didn't have any small fires for tens of years. It's only in the third world countries. Then they would have this calamities because of the gross violation of everything, of all rules, whatever else. People are bribing fire inspectors to give them the safety.
It helps you appreciate some of the simplest things of life that keep us safe in a place
yeah,
like
that. We take it for granted, but they're not granted.
Right. And on that note, we finish out what's really been yet another fascinating conversation. Dr. Yuri Maltsev, Professor of Economics at Carthage College, I'm grateful for every opportunity that we have to speak, and thank you for being part of the morning show.